Hi, welcome to the podcast. My name is Tim Andrews. I hope you're enjoying your weekend as much as I am. I've been on vacation the previous week. I'll be back with the Von Hessler Doctrine Tuesday, May 28th, which is the day after Memorial Day. This week is a huge treat for me. I've been a Frank Zappa fan for as long as I can remember, probably going back to my early teens, and also subsequently enjoying watching his son Dweezil take the mantle and expand it beyond it. They're two different people, obviously. We're not just going to talk about Frank, but Dweezil Zappa is returning to Atlanta with a full band. First tour in 4 years. The name of the tour is Rocks-postrophe, celebrating 50 years of the classic Zappa album Apostrophe, and also the live album Roxy and Elsewhere. That takes place Saturday, September 7th at the Eastern. Now, as of this recording, there are limited seats available, so you can just go to DweezilZappa.com. Dweezil has been an actor, a musician, of course. As always, you can get this full interview as a podcast the following Monday. Dweezil, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time, man. It's good to speak with you.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
And you're coming back to Atlanta September 7th. I saw you, God, when was it the last time? It was November 2016 at Variety. That was such a fun show.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's been a while. I can't remember if we were there before the pandemic hit or not, but I feel like we were there one time after 2016, but I can't recall.
Well, this is your first tour in what, 4 years?
Yeah.
And a lot to put together. You're kind of doing a mashup, I guess. Rocks-postrophe is the name of the show. Some songs from Apostrophe, some songs from Roxy and Elsewhere. So I've been following you along, and fans can follow along on your Instagram page. You're counting it down every day. Also, your website, which is DweezilZappa.com, where you're doing a blog. See, I didn't know. I'm diving in, and it's like peeling an orange that has endless amounts of segments because you are so multifaceted. I think it's awesome.
Oh, I appreciate it. This time, because we were starting from the ground up, we thought it might be interesting to really have a look and see what it takes to make a tour happen, not just the music, but everything. So we've been filming a lot of stuff, and we have a kind of behind the scenes reality show type of thing, mini documentary series that we're putting together that shows everything from the decision to go on tour all the way through the day-to-day stuff. And so you see a bit of it on Instagram and on my website, but the actual show thing that I'm talking about hasn't premiered yet. It'll be on my website, and it's been a lot to do all of it at once, because even when we really decided to do a lot of the filming, we were somewhere around 130 days until the first show, and that seems like a lot until you start thinking about all the stuff you have to do daily, and suddenly the time to learn songs becomes reduced to minutes, not hours.
Yeah.
And, it's a juggling act for sure.
How close of an approximation do you get to the original songs? Do you really work it so everything sort of sounds exactly like it was? Is that your goal, or do you want to expand on it with your own type of playing?
So in the past, we really treated it much more like classical music in that we would play it as written, especially if we had the written sheet music in my dad's handwriting, because that's the instructions. That's how the music is meant to be played. It's much more akin to classical music than other types of popular music or rock or jazz or whatever. This is really structured to be played as written. So for the most part, in the 14 years that I was touring before we stopped in 2020, pretty much followed that as the rule of thumb. And there were a few times where we would do hybrid arrangements where we'd take two or maybe even three versions of a song that my dad arranged different ways and played on different tours, and we'd put them into one song. And you would have the feeling of the different arrangements that he created. And so we're doing some of that, but there's very rarely any situation where I would take something in the music and just completely change it to be something of my own making, because it really seems unnecessary with this music. But that being said, on this tour, there's more of my own influence of different things texturally. I think things are more rock oriented than they have been in the past. And there's probably a few things where there's more surprises. There's more humor on this particular tour than we've done, because we just felt like, okay, if we're coming back, let's really have fun. Let's do some stuff that people have never seen before. And one of the main things instrumentally is that we have a musician who is also a very good drummer, besides playing guitar and singing and even doing some keyboards. He's a multi-instrumentalist, but that means we'll have double drums on songs throughout the show. And the Roxy album had a lot of double drums throughout that album and on tour. So we'll be able to replicate some of the sound and feel in a way that we have never done before.
And Roxy and Elsewhere is sonically a lot of fun to listen to, whether you're under the influence of something or not. You know, you can get under the influence of the music as well as, you know, any substances. But, you know, back when I started listening to Frank Zappa music, that was when I was experimenting a lot in my youth. And I think you can appreciate it a lot more if you're not under anything. And what I'm getting at is it is just amazing. And to be able to see it live, especially if you were too young in the 80s and 90s, well, the 80s, to see it live, this is just awesome. I mean, I'm babbling, but the last show I saw was amazing too. And to the way you perform it and the way you conduct the band, you really bring it to life. I think it's a great thing for fans to have.
Well, I appreciate it. We love the music, and we want the music to be the main focal point. So the project has always been fueled by the desire to play the music commensurate with the way that my dad would have had it played by the bands that he was conducting. So I want it to be an apples-to-apples comparison, and that goes all the way through to the sound of the music that's recreated on stage. We really tried to play with sounds and timbres of instrumentation that match the era of when the music was performed and recorded, because that makes a big difference too. It creates the actual time machine feeling of being transported to a different place in time when those things are evocative of the era.
Yeah. Well, speaking of time machines, as I was getting ready to do the interview, and I think I mentioned earlier, you're kind of an iceberg of creativity, whether it be music. You did a lot of television, movies, producing. Last night I sort of dove into that on YouTube. I watched some of your MTV stuff with Moon, and then I got back into an album I bought when it came out and I hadn't listened to in a long time, and I enjoyed it very much. So do you mind talking about Having a Bad Day a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was the first record that I made, a full-length record, and I was 15. We probably recorded it in about 10 days, maybe just under 2 weeks, and it was at the home studio in the basement of the house I grew up in Laurel Canyon. And my dad produced it, and I played a green guitar on every song, a Charvel Jackson guitar that I had recently gotten before the recording commenced. And it was interesting to make the full record, because prior to that, I had made something that was a single, two songs, My Mother's a Space Cadet and Crunchy Water, when I was 12 years old and only been playing guitar for about 9 months. And that was produced in the same studio, but by Edward Van Halen and Don Landy. So in the 3 years between doing that, I would hazard a guess to say that I obtained a little bit more musical skill and then put it to use on that record. But it was Chad Wackerman on drums and Scott Tunis, who played bass, and those guys both were playing in my dad's band at the time. So it was really just a trio. And then I ended up singing on the songs, and Moon sang lead vocals on one song. I don't even think there's really any background vocals on the record from what I remember, but it was just one of those things where it was like, okay, got a vocal on there, got some guitars, got some overdubs. Done. Yeah.
Well, that's Let's Talk About It, where she sings the lead, and the guitar in that is amazing. You're just ripping it to shreds in the solo. And the video for it is fascinating because like it's a time capsule of people who were famous. There's so many great cameos in that video. Was that all done in your house
yeah.
or your studio?
We did it at a studio where it was a soundstage, and the joke of it was that it was the idea that you could have this neighborhood get together where people would help you out and do something. And so I don't remember how many cameos are in it, but it's
a ton.
Don Johnson,
yeah.
Jane Fonda, Robert Wagner, my dad's in it, Charlie Sexton, Vince Neil.
Hey, stick around. More with Dweezil Zappa coming up next. It's the Popcast with Tim Andrews. Welcome back to the Popcast with Tim Andrews. My guest this week, Dweezil Zappa, picking up where we left off, talking about his 1986 single and the video for it. Let's Talk About It.
The joke of it was like Jane Fonda was doing craft service and, you know, giving people snacks.
Right.
And so it was kind of a funny little video to be made. And it got played a few times on MTV back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Quite a bit, actually, because we would wait. We waited. We watched the premiere, I guess. That's all we had. Small town, Pennsylvania. Once MTV came in, it turned us all into heathens. And we just really dug it, you know, because I think like a lot of Gen X kids whose parents might not have been into the music, the first introduction to Frank Zappa was Valley Girl. And then
yeah.
I would call the college station and annoy every DJ, every shift, requesting that song because I wanted to hear it. It was fun. It was, oh my God, this is being played on the radio. And I don't think I was sophisticated enough at 11 or 12 to really get into Zappa music. But as I got older, I did. I was more into metal, Van Halen. I liked Metallica and that kind of stuff. But as I got a little bit older, I was like, oh yeah, this is way better music.
Yeah, well, it's the music that you can discover and have a lifetime's worth of entertainment because there's so many layers to it, and there's so many albums with so many different styles. So it's a really treasure trove of stuff once you do discover it and get into it. And the people that get into it early, it becomes their lifelong benchmark for everything that comes after. You know, it does change people's perspective on life and what music can be, and just even what the creative process can be, because you listen to some of the things that my dad did and you just have to wonder, how did he come up with it? How did he get people to actually do it? You know, it's so crazy.
Yeah, and you can watch, you know, people who are just casual fans who don't do deep dives, they can go to YouTube and watch your dad as a teenager playing a bicycle on the old Steve Allen show. I mean, that's how far back it goes and how it still continues to be a very powerful force in music. You know, I will always put on an album. I have my favorites, but when I'm feeling feisty and I want to explore something new, I'll go, okay, I haven't listened to this yet. Let's put this on. So that's kind of how I deal with the music. My favorite is an album that I don't hear a lot about anymore, and that would be Thing Fish. The night I discovered that, I didn't stop listening to it for about a week and a half.
That's hilarious because that's one of the records that most people, if they hear something like that, they never go back to listening to the music again. If that was the first introduction to the music, they just don't understand it. Yet, at the same time, for the people that do get into it and hang on with it from there, that's always entertaining to me to see that's the entry point and they stuck around.
Well, it's a backwards thing because if you listen to that and you enjoy it, which I always have, because I kind of get it, and of course it's also funny. That's important to me. The dialogue and everything is really well written and performed well. But you can go back and once you start listening to earlier albums, you go, oh, that's on Thing Fish. Oh, that's on Thing Fish too. Oh, that's on Thing Fish. So I get it now. like the torture never stops or the torchum never stops. I was running around during the pandemic going, you got to listen to this record. It's connected.
Yeah, there's so many things in the music that are, I referred to my dad as the rock and roll Nostradamus because he has predicted the future of social activities and whatnot so many times over in many of the songs. But if you look at where things are now and how things are turning into AI-driven stuff and things that are going to be just implanted into people's heads to where they're going to be having relationships with inanimate objects, and that's going to be more important than real people. You look at the Joe's Garage record and the whole vacuum cleaner and all of that stuff. It's just crazy.
I turned on I interviewed a comedian last week who's from Germany. He's 30 years old. And I turned him on to, I can't say it again on the radio. God. You miserably whorins.
Yeah.
And he goes, that's very dirty. You can't say that on the air. I'll bleep it.
Yeah.
You also do a podcast that people can find on your website. And I'm going to dive into that. That's next. You're just exclusively talking about Van Halen.
Yes. And you mentioned that you're a Van Halen fan, so you'll probably enjoy the deep dive. Most of the episodes are done in the structure of taking an album and going song by song and talking about the details in the guitar work and what the band did to make it sound the way that it did, and the production aspects. All of those things are really looked at in great detail.
All of us fans call him Eddie Van Halen. Dweezil calls him Edward Van Halen. I think it's a term of respect. More with Dweezil Zappa when we return. It's the Popcast with Tim Andrews. Welcome back to the Popcast with Tim Andrews, picking up where we left off with Dweezil talking about Edward Van Halen and his influence on Dweezil's playing. He was a huge influence on you as much as your father was, guitar-wise?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about Edward Van Halen's guitar playing, and my dad is actually the one who came up with the phrase that is widely quoted, but he thanked Edward Van Halen for reinventing the electric guitar. And it really was that idea in my mind as a kid where I had seen my dad play guitar and it made sense. You know, I watched what he did, but it seemed so complicated based on what was happening in the music and the fact that he was improvising and creating these stories with the guitar. When I heard Edwards playing, it was similar, but it was more compartmentalized and more guitar centric in a way that I was able to really focus on the details that were specific to the guitar. I could hear them so much more out in front of the music, which allowed me to then want to just learn everything I could hear. So when I was hearing that stuff at 12 years old, I just had the ability to focus and say to myself, oh, one day you'll be able to play this. You just got to keep working at it, which is something I said about my dad's music, but I always knew I had to know a lot more about music until I could actually play that stuff.
Right. Yeah, if you're an artist and you want to be a good impressionist, you first have to learn how to draw realistically. I've always been told that. And, in any kind of art, you really have to start with the fundamentals before you can just go out and be an improviser. You can't just throw paint on a wall and go, I'm an artist. You can, but, it's incredulous.
it's a tricky thing, though, because, some people find exactly what they do very early on and they just stay on that path. There's a few guitar players that you could look at that way. Edward's one of them. He really just had his own way of doing things from the ground up, Derek Trucks is a guy that you can listen to his playing. When he was playing at 13 years old, you can hear exactly his roots that are still there in his playing now. So for me, it's a little different. I think if you listen to my playing from record to record, it changes pretty drastically based on whatever new stuff I've been learning or experimenting with. And it wasn't until I was playing on tour and playing my dad's music for years that I think I eventually stumbled on something that became a sound of my own in terms of my guitar style. I've always been able to utilize different techniques and things and turn them into something that can tell a story during a guitar solo, but to really tell that story at the speed of thought and have enough vocabulary to match the kind of stuff that my dad did, that just took years of playing on stage and doing stuff to get even in the ballpark. And, you know, that's what, when I go back out on this tour, will be interesting to see what's the new elements of the vocabulary that I will be able to access and put into what I do.
Now, when you're finished with the tour, do you go into a studio and start recording, or are you going to continue doing some remixing and I don't know if it's fixing is the right word, but you recently did Deep Purple's Machine Head. There's a super deluxe edition that's available. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to it with the headphones on as loud as I could, and it's amazing. There's stuff coming out of that mix that I've never heard on the radio in my life. And I've heard these songs a thousand times.
Yeah, I had fun working on that because it's one of my favorite records, and it certainly has a lot of great musicianship, and the songwriting is unique to that band. But there, in the 70s, there was a style of record making that it sounds great. Everybody got used to it, and we loved the records from that era. But there was a certain thing about just trying to capture the performance and leave it slightly untouched, leave it so that it feels like you've documented a moment in time. And also at that time, there wasn't as much of an extended range in terms of frequencies that could be broadcast or reproduced by audio equipment. So people didn't spend the time to try to emphasize every element that is in the recording. Now you cut to what you just talked about, the brand new box set with the 2024 remixes. Those were intended to do exactly what you talked about, find the areas that could be enhanced and increase the frequency range, you know, so utilize the low end and the other hidden aspects, things that were masking other things and bringing out more detail. So the songs do have more of an excitement factor on first listen because you do notice things that you didn't even know were there before.
Yeah, the keyboards, the bass that was buried before, I thought it was bass. I'm starting to hear it now. It's sort of, it might have been last year or the year before, there was a reissue of Animals by Pink Floyd, and there was stuff in that reissue, the remix, that I had never heard in my life. And I've listened to that album a thousand times. Things that are a lot crisper and that are coming out from underneath all the production that was put into it. Do you think?
Yeah, it's just one of those things where when you get a chance to work on stuff like that, you think about it from your own perspective of what do I want to hear more of? And then you also want to find a way to make it so that the fans can have a distinctively different experience so that when they're buying something that's a brand new box set, there's an actual reason to buy it because it is different, not just, it was remastered and it's louder.
No, there's more to it than the loudness, my friends. Listen to it.
Yeah.
Listen to it. Are there any of your dad's studio albums that could benefit from a remix, or would you never touch them?
Oh, I would love to work on them. It's just a question of whether or not I will get the opportunity to do
time.
It.
Yeah,
it would be fun to do them in Atmos and even new stereo.
And would anybody ever perform Thing Fish live again?
I seriously doubt it. You know, it's one of those things, you know, people, if they do some research and they listen to it, they'll start hearing it within a few moments and think, oh my God, how was this ever released? Because it was in a day where it not everything was so ridiculously politically incorrect or correct, is the way people say it now. But it's like, I don't even know why there's such a fascination with people not being able to have their own freedom of thought in this day and age. But it is, people are, I think some people are waking up to the fact that there still ought to be the ability to have common sense.
So I can quote from a movie that you're in, these are on the banned list.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, when that came out and I saw you were in that movie, I thought it was, you got to realize, man, you were cool as can be to a guy like me back in the 80s and still are. But you know what I mean? Seeing you in a movie like that or watching you on MTV, I'm like, it's Dweezil. Dweezil's our Zappo. He's our Zappo.
Well, you know, the thing about doing different things in life is that you end up having a full experience of testing the waters. And, you know, people always have said to me, you know, like, I don't really know what you do because you've done a lot of different things and you don't seem to stay focused on anything for too long of a period. And to me, it's all part of the same thing. It's just a creative pursuit of let's see what happens if I do this. You know, I mean, it's it really isn't a game plan. But I did get a chance to have some fun experiences and do some different things. And that ends up giving you a different perspective on life. You know, I ultimately think that everybody learns from every experience they have, and you just try to do the best with it all that you can. And I like taking on new challenges and trying different things. So
one more segment with Dweezil Zappa is coming up next. If you want to find out more about Dweezil, and why wouldn't you? You can go to DweezilZappa.com. All the information about the Rockspostrophe tour, links to the Running with the Dweezil podcast about Van Halen, specifically Eddie Van Halen, and just tons and tons of stuff you can watch and listen to. Again, that's DweezilZappa.com. Dweezil will be playing in Atlanta on Saturday, September 7th at the Eastern, which is on Memorial Drive. For more tickets and information, did I say it? Oh, yeah, DweezilZappa.com. It's the Popcast with Tim Andrews. And my mama cried. Welcome back to the Popcast with Tim Andrews, my guest Dweezil Zappa, talking about how he's preparing for this upcoming tour. And people can watch that evolving every single day as you're getting ready for the tour on your Instagram page. This is what I'm doing today. This is the style I'm doing. This is how I practice in the morning. What'd you call it? Popcorn. Getting up in the morning. And so it's hard work. You don't just show up and play Apostrophe and Roxy and Elsewhere. So.
No. These songs and some of the other stuff that we're putting in the show, it's hard to play, but it's also hard to memorize. And, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges is the retention of learning a lot of stuff all at once. If you had to try to do something like this, it's the equivalent of saying, hey, all right, I'm going to memorize the phone book and I have 130 days to do it. And, you know, at first you don't know where to start. You just start trying to read the stuff and trying to memorize things. And then as you get further along, you're like, oh, now I don't remember this thing anymore. Now I got to go back to that. And you have this balancing act of what you remember and what you don't. And, you know, you, you just keep working on it till you got enough of it in muscle memory. And then as the band puts it all together and you work it from top to bottom, you just hope that everybody's around the same level of retention so that the songs can actually get on their feet. And that's where it starts to get down to the wire, and some people may know songs better than others, and then you have to keep cycling the hard parts. And yeah. It's not like, oh yeah, we just know this, we just get up and play it. It really is like doing exercises. You know, you're like, oh man, I got to do 50 more push-ups. My God.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, it's something you have to do every single day in order to do it the way you want it to sound, I imagine. You can't just, you know, you don't have, I'm a deadhead, or I was a deadhead. And there's shows in the last 5-10 years with John Mayer and stuff. They're increasingly slower and slower and slower. So years ago, I sort of drifted into Phish. And to get me to that point, and I know you probably got to get back to practice, but Phish, I notice a lot of influence of your dad's in the way Trey plays guitar. And I'm curious if you thought the same thing, if you've ever listened.
I haven't listened to a lot of what they do. I have heard them play Peaches on Regalia on a few occasions, seen some videos and things. So I know that there is a tip of the cap there. But I think from what I understand about Phish and what people like about them is they like to see that they will go on some sort of extravagant improv and change the arrangement of a song so that you hear a song differently. If you've seen them a bunch of times, now you're seeing the same song you've seen, but it's different because the arrangement is different or it has a different improv, which is also a huge part of what my dad's music was always designed to be, and which was another reason he was so heavily bootlegged, because he could do a whole tour and be playing virtually the same songs or set list, but they never really are the same because of the improvisational elements that happen in them. And that's a pretty clever thing to be able to put into your writing and arranging. And in one particular case, one of the songs that's on this tour, there's a song called Approximate, and it's the ultimate example of that, because it's a piece of music whose instructions are that you have certain pitches that you must play, but the rest you have to play rhythmically correct, but whatever notes you want to play in that rhythm. So that means that every time the song is played, it will, by design, be completely different.
That's amazing. Is that that's a challenge, right?
Oh, yeah. It's very hard.
Yes. Well, I look forward to going to the show. I very much appreciate you sharing some of your time with me today. Like I said, pinpointed the moment when, like, yeah, you're our Zappa. And I actually did meet you, I don't know how many years ago, 20-some years ago. You were doing a radio tour for a food show, and you were in the studio where I worked.
Cool. It was the show with Lisa Loeb.
Rocksapostrophe, celebrating 50 years of Apostrophe and Roxy and Elsewhere, Saturday, September 7th at the Eastern. Limited seating still available, so you can go to DweezelZappa.com to find that or any other show if you're listening somewhere else in the country. Dweezel, very much appreciate you taking the time, man. It was great talking to you.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much. And we'll see you at the show.
Yeah, see you there. That's going to do it for the podcast with Tim Andrews this week. Thank you to my guest, Dweezel Zappa. Don't forget, he's coming to the Eastern on September 7th. Go to DweezelZappa.com for tickets and more information and just a ton of entertainment. The full interview is available as a podcast Monday afternoon. No cuts, no edits. Coming up at 11 tonight, it's Jared Yamamoto in the Nightcap. Thanks for listening to the podcast with Tim Andrews.